Good evening, everyone. Hello and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talks, joining you from India. And I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on multiple myeloma on Cure Talks' 85th episode. My co-host for the talk is myeloma advocate and editor of MyelomaSurvival.com, Gary Peterson. And supporting Gary is our esteemed myeloma panel of advocates, Pat Killingsworth and Jack Arello. We are truly excited to have amongst us a very distinguished expert, Dr. Craig Hoffmeister. Dr. Hoffmeister is Assistant Professor of Medicine at the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center and is currently working on a breakthrough myeloma treatment therapy. Welcome to Cure Talks, Dr. Hoffmeister.
Thank you so much.
I would like to remind our audience that we will be addressing questions sent in via email towards the end of the discussion. If you have a question for our expert, you can let us know by pressing 1 on your keypads or mail them to priya@trilex.com. With that, I now hand over to Gary to begin with the discussion. Gary, you're on air.
Well, thank you very much, Priya, and as always, thank you for bringing this great educational format for all myeloma patients. Dr. Hoffmeister is an associate professor of medicine at the Ohio State University and is the lead of the section of plasma cell dyscrasia. And one might ask, or one might Google, what is dyscrasia? Well, it happens to be plasma cell dyscrasias are produced as a result of abnormal proliferation of a monoclonal population of plasma cells that may or may not secrete detectable levels of monoclonal immunoglobulin or immunoglobulin fragments, paraprotein or M-protein. The net is it's either MGUS, multiple myeloma, solitary plasmacytomas of the bone, extramedullary plasmacytomas, Waldenstrom's disease, primary amyloidosis, light chain deposition disease, paraproteinemia, and heavy chain disease. And thank goodness he just called it dyscrasia. But in addition to this research, his research interest, he is a attending physician in lymphoma, myeloma, and bone marrow transplant service. He is an ad hoc reviewer of publications, including Blood Journal of Clinical Oncology, Clinical Cancer Research, and the British Journal of Hematology. In addition to others, he is the recipient of the Image M. Moore Award and Business First 40 Under 40 Award in Ohio and the Ohio State University College of Medicine. So thank you very much, Doctor, and we certainly do appreciate you being here. Could you tell us, T cells are a type of white blood cell, and our listeners may not necessarily know what a CAR T cell is for use in cancer treatment. And could you please give us a definition of what is a CAR T cell and a history of its use in a cancer treatment, in the cancer treatment armamentarium, if you would?
Absolutely. So a CAR T cell is not automotive. There's no transportation involved here. CAR, like many acronyms in medicine, stands for chimeric antigen receptor. And the idea here is that T cells are part of your immune system, and your immune system lives in your bone marrow and your blood, and those two areas are really connected. So in your immune system, T cells and B cells are both different types of white blood cells, and your blood is made up of white cells, red cells, and platelets. Now, T cells have T cell receptors on their surface, and that helps them recognize what belongs in the body and what doesn't belong in the body. And the idea is that T cells use this T cell receptor, as well as other receptors, to figure out if there's potentially a foreign invader in your body, bacteria, fungus, all sorts of things that might come in, and attack it and kill it. And that's what the T cell receptor does in general quite well. But cancer is crafty, and cancer essentially creates on its cell surface and around it a protective layer so that your own T cells don't recognize these cancer cells as foreign. So to get around this, you can, through genetic modification, force a T cell to put up a chimeric T cell, a somewhat synthetic T cell on its surface, forcing that T cell to recognize a particular antigen or a particular protein on the cell surface of whatever cell you're looking for. And for us, it's all myeloma cells. So a CAR T cell is a genetically engineered T cell that targets towards at least one, but potentially more than one, target on a myeloma cell. And CAR T cells have a difficult history. This has been in investigation in clinical trials and in laboratories for decades. And there's a lot been modified, how the T cells are created, how to make a T cell and genetically modify it, not to mention the targets that these T cells look for. Now, over time, we've had a lot of CAR T cells that were in clinical trial that did not really have much effect. And over the years, modifications have occurred to make these CAR T cells more effective. And most recently, these CAR T cells have been used effectively in other blood cancers, specifically ALL, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And ALL and CLL have had some fabulous results, and there's also been a number of great results in a type of aggressive lymphoma called diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, which is a type of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And there are many, many clinical trials using CAR T-cells currently in process or actually ongoing and accruing patients in a number of cancers, but certainly a number of them looking at ALL, CLL, and lymphoma.
Okay. How does this prior research apply to myeloma treatment?
So most of the work has looked at other blood cancers and been successful. And what we would like to do is be part of another wave of CAR T cell trials looking at diseases other than CLL and ALL. And for us, myeloma is the focus. Now, there are two clinical trials, CAR T trials, currently accruing myeloma patients. One's at University of Pennsylvania, looking for myeloma patients who express a target called CD19, and many myeloma cells express CD19 at a very low level, and that low level may be quite enough. There is another CAR T trial currently enrolling at the NCI, National Cancer Institute, for patients whose myeloma expresses a target called BCMA, B-cell maturation antigen. And so they're looking for myeloma, BCMA-positive myeloma patients, and that is a good proportion of myeloma patients, for a CAR T cell trial there. I believe there is a third CAR T trial looking for a NKG2D2A antigen on the cell surface of myeloma cells and also on the cell surface of patients with AML, acute myeloblastic leukemia, or acute myelogenous leukemia. And that's, I think, going to be open at Dana-Farber, but I don't know if that started accruing patients yet. So it won't be long before we have three active trials accruing myeloma patients for CAR T cells. And we would like to join this group, and we hope to have a clinical trial open next year for CAR T cells targeting a CS1 antigen, which is CS1 is the protein otherwise known as SLAMF7, if that doesn't roll off your tongue, that is on the cell surface of the majority of myeloma patients that we've tested so far.
Okay, now you mentioned this research on CS1 gene and it being the target. So does this, and does this mean, you know, and I understand, you know, what you're doing, at least, you know, in the broadest terms. But I understand that it's this target and off-target issue, and how has that been addressed in, you know, the other cancers, and how is it being addressed in myeloma as well?
So, you know, this is following a target CS1. That's what we're trying to engineer T cells to target on myeloma patients. And there's actually an antibody targeting CS1 that's being used in clinical trials and is not currently FDA approved, but is being tested in a clinical trial in combination with a common drug, Revlimid, and dexamethasone, plus or minus this drug, elotuzumab. And that drug has made it through phase 1, 2, and currently phase 3 testing. And so we're hoping that that gives us some evidence of safety. But just because there's an antibody, and it's just a naked antibody, it just targets it, but it's not attached to a cell or anything. And that's essentially how antibodies work. They blanket cells with these antibodies and hope that just because antibodies are on the outer surface of these cells, that that causes your body to chew up the cells. That we hope that elotuzumab's experience showing it to be safe in patients with myeloma will kind of paves the way and demonstrates that we hope it'll be safe for these CAR T cells targeting CS1. Now, CAR T cells are not naked antibodies. This is a T cell. And so even low levels of expression of CS1 could get us into trouble if there's low-level expression of CS1 on important organs that we don't honestly know about or have not tested, or there's cross-reactivity with other proteins. Thus far in the tests that we have, that we have no evidence of this, but certainly that's a big concern. So we call that on-target, off-tumor side effects. And we certainly don't want to have that, but we're wary of that, as other CAR T-cell trials in the past have had on-target, off-tumor effects, which have led to significant side effects for patients. So we want to avoid that, and working to try to address that as best we can before this goes into clinical trial when patients are exposed. Interestingly, you kind of worry that if there's this elotuzumab out there and that this is used in myeloma patients, that, well, if every myeloma patient starts getting exposed to the CS1 antibody, maybe at the time that that antibody is no longer effective, that means that patients' myeloma cells won't express CS1. We don't know that yet. So that's another concern, and I guess that's dealing with the fact that a drug could cause a proportion of myeloma patients to not express CS1 in the future, making our CAR T cell trial, or our CAR T cells ineffective. We don't know if that's the case, but that's a theoretical concern.
That happened, didn't it, with you know, the leukemia trial, that some of those that were, was it CD19?
Mm-hmm.
And that the leukemia cancer then quit expressing CD19, but it was still there.
Right, and it's likely that what happened was that there was a different clone or a group of leukemia cells that weren't the majority, but was actually a small minority that didn't express CD19. And when all these CAR T cells came about, they killed all the cancer cells that expressed CD19, allowing the CD19 negative cancer cells to take over. And obviously the CD19 focused CAR T cells are going to be ineffective. We don't know if that's going to be a big issue in myeloma for CS1, for CD19, or for BCMA, any target currently.
Okay, those pesky little cancer cells, huh? Keep on morphing. And
it's a question of really whether it's morphing or whether, because the majority of myeloma patients at diagnosis have a number of clones around, so 2 to 6 kind of different clones or tribes of myeloma cells at diagnosis. So those, and it's not that they all go away, it's just that at relapse, usually one clone takes over, but the other clones really aren't usually gone.
Okay. I understand you already had some really very positive results. Could you explain these results and what the next steps will be in the development of this treatment?
So the positive results so far form the basis for the clinical trial. So we've tested it in cells from cell lines. We've tested it against cells that we got from bone marrow aspirates from patients. We've tested it in mouse models that use cell lines in these mouse models to kind of get a better idea of how it works in an actual animal. Those tests have all been very effective. And when we see the cells die, when we see the mice have myeloma everywhere and then take a picture of them after the CAR T cells go in and you can't find any myeloma, that's always very reassuring and positive and suggestive that this will be effective in humans. But, you know, how many inbred mice have we cured of cancer? Lord knows, there's quite a lot. And what we hope to do is try to bring this to patients, because inbred mice really aren't as reflective of a patient's immune system and the complexity of human disease as we would like. Now, we're working on this at the same time, trying to develop newer, more accurate, more reflective mouse models that bring in a lot of the complexity of the human immune system so that we can test it before we expose patients to this, and that work's ongoing.
Next, you're going to tell me that your mouse models don't come from Victoria's Secret. Is that right?
Sadly enough, the
well, you
the,
gave me the car joke, so...
Yeah, we don't call them
the
angels
mouse model
either.
Joke. Okay. All right, and this next one is I think quite important, and that is, as is the case with many outstanding clinical trial ideas, we understand that yours is not yet totally funded, and how can we and the audience help to make this happen?
So I appreciate you asking. You know, you can never say you have funding until it's done, until the trial is there and everything's, you know, every patient's been treated. And we're still trying to work out the exact cost of each patient. But from other CAR T cell trials, not ours, we know that in general CAR T cell trials cost an extraordinary amount per patient, somewhere between $100,000 and $500,000 to just treat a single patient. And that covers obtaining the patient's own T cells, genetically modifying them, expanding those genetically modified cells in a sterile and supportive environment, and then infusing those cells back into the patient and monitoring the patient for side effects and for effectiveness. That's a big task, and it's incredibly expensive. And there's a lot of effort to try to show that this will be successful for the patient's own T cells, and to think about, well, what's the second generation of these trials, the third generation? What can we do to make these even more effective, even safer, and with less cost? And that's all coming down the pike. If you're reacting to this thinking, oh, this is way too expensive, why would we even be in support of this? This is the first wave. And the first wave is never perfect. And we will continue, even as we get this clinical trial up and going, to find ways to make the treatment better, safer, and more cost-effective. To support this research, our clinical trial specifically, we're doing everything we can. We are looking to industry partners. We've written scientific grants to a number of funding agencies. We've even had a crowdfunding campaign through endmyeloma.org. So anything we can to try to support the research to get it quickly from where it stands now to actual patients accruing, that's what we're interested in.
Okay. Well, thank you, Doctor. And what I'd like to do now is to open it up to our distinguished panel. And if Pat Killingsworth, are you on the line?
I'm here, Gary.
All right, Pat, your questions.
Hi, Doctor. I have a couple questions. I know it's difficult to get consensus that you're all trying to find the magic acronym plus number, whatever you'd call a CS1 or a WT1 or whatever. And I understand how difficult it is, and I thank you so much for basically giving your life to try to save ours. I mean, it's amazing, so thank you. It seems to me there are two types of safety, though. There's safety as in, is the T-cell therapy safe? But then what about the opportunity cost lost? And what I mean is, so you're fiddling around with the CAR T cells and you're doing this other stuff, and in the meantime, there's no maintenance, maybe no Revlimid or pomalidomide or Velcade or Kyprolis or whatever. Isn't there a danger from that aspect also?
So I guess that your question focuses on, are we putting with this therapy, with these patients, are we putting all our eggs in one basket and expecting these CAR T cells to do everything? Shouldn't we kind of not forget some of the therapy that came before and is ongoing?
Well, that's a good point. I wasn't going there, but we should go there. No, I was just thinking that while you're doing, for example, another doctor that we're considering supporting is working, and his target is WT1. And so you go through this process, and if that doesn't work, you haven't been using the tried and true drugs that have been helping keep a patient's myeloma under control. And isn't there a real risk to that?
Well, I mean, the patients that, you know, are eligible for this trial have in many ways been there, done that. They've seen most or all of the effective therapies, and there's not much else that can be safely given.
Sure.
So these patients that we think of here, or that are eligible for a good section of these trials, don't have a lot of other options, or if they do have other options, it's clear from the pace of their disease that the current options are not sustainable. There certainly are experiments ongoing at our center and others that are looking to combine CAR T cells with other therapies to try to make the CAR T cells more effective and to see if they're in essence synergistic or antagonistic in any way. And as you'd expect, there are experiments ongoing at many centers now looking at multiple CAR T-cell targets at the same time. If one is might be effective, wouldn't it be better and you increase your chances to have two or even three CAR T-cell targets? So,
sure, I was going to ask about that.
Absolutely. All those scientific experiments are ongoing, and all of them, and you'd imagine the most successful are going to translate to the clinic. So absolutely, I agree with you, is that we need to be thinking, well, is the target right? Is the way we genetically modify the T cells right? Are we, you know, missing something in terms of how we treat the patients to kind of keep them in bounds and safe after they have the CAR T cells? This is something we can do along the way to make it easier for the CAR T cells to expand, to kill, but yet not hurt the patient in all this expansion. So most clinical trials ongoing now question at least some aspect of this.
Sure. And it just has to be so difficult. The patients you're getting are so darn beat up. That can't make it easy either. You're fighting a very trained and wily foe by the time you get to where you're doing your trial, so that has to make things even more difficult. Can you explain, now are you doing this in conjunction with allogeneic transplantation?
So, you know, the vast majority of allogeneic transplants in myeloma that are standard allogeneic transplants, you know, those are usually not very popular or terribly effective in myeloma. Its unpopularity is related to the fact that it's not terribly effective. Certainly, there are some novel strategies to make allogeneic transplant more effective. But for our trial and for many, most, for the two other CAR T cell trials that, the three other CAR T cell trials that are either accruing or in production, you know, none of them are necessarily required or linked to an allogeneic transplant. And that's different than CLL and especially than ALL, because both of those have had a closer link to transplantation, because in those diseases, allogeneic transplant has had a little bit more successful history.
Sure, and so there's no auto involved either. This is a sort of a
right. Freestanding.
Well, that's nice from a safety standpoint. That's
absolutely
that's great.
And you know, the UPenn group, their CAR T trial targeting CD19 to myeloma patients is tied up in an auto transplant, and so, you know, that could be, you know, that changes the patient selection. It changes potentially some of the risks. And it's certainly incredibly different from a patient standpoint in terms of expected toxicities, et cetera.
Sure.
We don't know which will be better. And
sure.
So it's an interesting hypothesis to link it there. And it may be the best way to do it, as that type of immunosuppression from that dose of chemotherapy may be what's needed for expansion of the CAR T cells. We don't know. And that's a big question. The UPenn group is fabulous in looking at the kinetics of how these cells expand. And we'll all be looking to try to figure out what's the best environment for these CAR T cells to expand and be effective.
Great. Thank you. I just have one more general question. There seems to be no consensus with this. What is your opinion? And if in an allo transplant, is GVHD, graft versus host disease, necessary, do you think, to slow down or kill myeloma, or do you think that it could be done without the GVHD? And of course, then that would make the procedure a lot safer, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I mean, you describe quite concisely the holy grail of allogeneic transplantation: graft versus tumor without graft versus host. And there are, you know, 10 interventions we can list off real quick of things that are ongoing in clinical trials to test if that particular intervention gets us closer to an allogeneic transplant that has graft versus tumor without graft versus host. Currently, you know, you'd say that the majority of patients who have clear graft versus effective graft versus tumor have some evidence of chronic graft versus host disease. But this chronic graft versus host disease is not like pregnancy. It is not yes or no. It is a huge spectrum of symptoms, side effects, signs, so that a little chronic graft versus host disease from a patient's perspective and a physician perspective is drastically different from graft versus host disease, which is lethal. And there is everything in between. So I think that currently chronic graft versus host disease is often linked to effective graft versus tumor. And clearly with a lot of interventions to try to dissociate those two so we can get graft versus tumor without GVHD.
Sure, interesting. Well, I want, before you describe exactly what you were trying to do and your next step, why don't I turn things over to Jack? Jack, are you there?
I'm here. You can hear me okay?
Yeah, I hear you great. Thanks, Gary.
You bet. Jack,
Dr. Hoffmeister, I appreciate being able to meet you over the phone, and I'm really encouraged by your explaining this very complex issue to us. I was fortunate enough a couple and a half months ago to hear Dr. Carl June of the University of Pennsylvania speak on this subject, and he, off the side, did mention that, as you said, they tried these CAR T cells modified CD19 on a few myeloma patients, and he further indicated, to his surprise, some of them showed some response, and he wasn't sure why, because as you indicated, CD19 is not much of a marker on myeloma cells. And I was wondering if we understand more about why there was a response now, and do you know, was the response a durable response, even if it's only a few months?
So I don't have a update on durability. He did describe this data at the American Society of Hematology meeting in December 2014, and I have not heard an update since then. And, you know, CD19, you know, Carl June is a wonderful scientist, and he's right to be questioning and be a little bit surprised that you'd see a response, because it's not thought to be a characteristic marker of myeloma. But even a small density of this target on the cell surface may be enough for these CAR T cells to have activity and to be effective anti-tumor agents if the target is present, even rarely, on the cell surface. Now, the question is durability, just as you say. A, do the cells, are we able to create genetically engineered CAR T cells so that they persist in myeloma? Because we don't necessarily know that they'll persist in myeloma as well or as long as they did in ALL or CLL. And the next question is, just because you are able to kill all the myeloma cells that even have rare expression of CD19, does that just mean that we nip off some of the clones, but that resistant clones that are CD19 negative won't creep up? And to my knowledge, those questions are not yet answered from the UPenn group. We know that from the NCI group, for their BCMA CAR T trial, that there are some patients who don't express BCMA. The predominant clone that presents in those relapse patients didn't have BCMA, so they couldn't enroll on the trial. We don't know what percentage of relapsed myeloma patients are BCMA negative. So we're interested to see how effective that would be. And, it's literally on the tip of your tongue and brain that, oh, wow, wouldn't it be great if we could do two CAR T trial targets at the same time, or three. I just find my brain heading there super quick. But I think that because the risks are so significant, we have to keep plodding along bit by bit to be sure that we don't all jump on the bandwagon of a therapy that's too dangerous.
With your decision to build the CS1 CAR T cell, you're doing that because more myeloma cells express CS1, and that's the reason elotuzumab, monoclonal antibody for CS1, has been developed as well, correct?
Yes, it's our hypothesis that the majority of relapsed myeloma patients have CS1 on the cell surface of myeloma, and it's our hypothesis as well that we think it's less likely that we'll have CS1 negative myeloma cells in patients than the other targets that we tested.
I was going to ask, do you ever envision elotuzumab, the monoclonal antibody, and the CS1 CAR T cell being used as part of the same treatment? But maybe that doesn't make sense if you believe that all of the myeloma cells in a relapsed patient already have CS1 present.
And, you know, I think you could conceive that an antibody targeting the same thing would compete for the same targets, I guess, even though these antibodies are going to wash out, whereas ideally the CAR T cells won't. What we think about is, well, are there ways to make the target more dense on the cell surface of myeloma cells? So could we give a patient a drug that increases their expression of the target, CS1? Or could we give the patient a drug that, when the CAR T cells are bathed essentially in this drug, that they're more effective killers? Or even on the other side, that if they're bathed in this drug, they kill, but they don't kill so rapidly, because that has also been a source of significant side effects for patients who have CAR T cells expand too quickly in patients when the CAR T cells get in there and all they see is target. Sometimes it's like a bomb going off, and sometimes you want that to be muted.
And you mentioned earlier the idea of creating a CAR T cell that not only targets CS1 but would also target CD38 and the other antigens that are being looked at via flow, the 6 or 8 others. I mean, and you think that's possible to create a CAR T cell like that?
Yes.
Cool. And I guess the last question, I got this again from Dr. June. He envisioned a time where you might almost think about CAR T cells like blood banks, where you could have these CAR T cells on a shelf being given to a patient as opposed to have to be harvested and re-engineered from that specific patient. Do you envision that as possible?
Absolutely. That's probably about those clinical trials are probably less than 12 months away.
Well, that's exciting. I'll stop asking questions, and I really appreciate the work you're doing.
Thank you so much.
And thank you, Jack. Priya, would you like to bring on the listeners at this point?
Is there anybody? Yes, a person calling in from 394-5741. Please ask your question. You're on air. Person calling in from 394-5741. You're on air. Please ask your question.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Yes, my question has to do with basically the nature of the trials, and also whether or not therapy is eventually planned to be a one-time therapy. Normally, I presume these are phase one trials. Normally, phase one trials are designed to find a proper dosage, but I'm gathering from what you're saying that in this case, this may be an attempt to determine whether or not the modified CAR T cells will stick around long enough to continue to do the job. Is that basically what part of the goal is for these trials? And also, is it hope that eventually there will just be one of these $500,000 therapies necessary to treat a patient?
Well, I think that of the at least 64 active CAR T cell trials that I see here for a variety of diseases, when I go on clinicaltrials.gov, they're questioning most everything: single dose, more than one dose, different doses of cells in patient, different lymphodepletion strategies, in essence, different chemotherapy. There's not a question that I think is too small for us to consider. And I think that the cost of these trials and interventions, when they actually become available for outside of a clinical trial, you know, envisioning that world so it's not $500,000 a dose is not hard to see. You know, if you only do it once and you're thinking, comparing it to a myeloma patient who may get 10 years of therapy, well, clearly a one-time $500,000 charge is his cost savings. But again, the idea of a $500,000 one-time treatment is not real exciting to anyone who's bought a copy of Quicken online. So I think we're all looking for single treatments that are going to be even less expensive. And things that we just talked about, having essentially a bank of CAR T cells available for specific tumors, would certainly be much less than, you know, taking personalizing or genetically engineering every patient's T cells. That would be much less expensive, and that's clearly where the field is going, or at least experimenting, but its effectiveness is unknown.
Thank you.
Gary, I think we can go on to a long list of questions that we have received via email.
All right, then that's exactly what we'll do. Okay, Doctor, let's go down the list. We've got a number of them here, and the first of which is this. Somebody would like to understand, and this is really specific to them, and we might as well start off with it then. I think it's the only one this way. I'd like to understand what the increase in light change has to do with my myeloma. I have gone from a low three-digit number to a high four-digit number.
So I think that you know, light chains and monoclonal proteins are really the protein products of myeloma cells, and we use them as an indirect measure of the number of myeloma cells in the patient. So if a particular patient's myeloma makes a set of light chain or a proportion of light chains, and that amount of light chains in the blood changes, you'd expect that there'd be an increase in the number of myeloma cells in that patient, and therefore you'd conclude that the patient's myeloma is not in good control. And that's a dangerous spot, because when the patient's myeloma is not in control, they're at increased risk for fractures, anemia, and kidney failure, and those are all bad things. So I think an increase in your light chain suggests your myeloma is not in control, and we need to do some different therapy to get it back under control.
Okay, well, thank you for that. I'm sure she, or whoever that was, appreciates that. What, the next question is, are there any contraindications to this therapy, which is the one you're talking about, CAR T cells, or any drug interactions that you suspect could occur and one should be aware of?
So the things I think about are the contraindications are that if you have a CAR T trial towards a particular target and the patient's myeloma, or at least the predominant clone, does not express that target, well, that would be something that you and I would be unexcited about. So that would be a contraindication to therapy because you'd expect it wouldn't work. As far as drug interactions, if you thought about it for a second, you can think, well, you know, if we have a patient is taking medications that prevent their white cells from expanding, that essentially are immunosuppressants. And this comes about is if a patient is taking immunosuppressants to decrease their risk or decrease the manifestations of graft versus host disease, those often are immunosuppressants. And you don't want immunosuppressants when you give a CAR T cell therapy. You want the CAR T cells to be able to expand whenever they see the target. And if you're taking medications like Prograf or Cytoxan or Cellcept or any of a variety of drugs that are immunosuppressive, we theorize, although we don't know, that that might make the CAR T cells less likely to expand and therefore be less effective.
Well, thank you. How long would it take for this therapy to be administered and in what form? Injections or oral? Would you talk a little about the dosage in which this would be effective?
So the basically you need to get a certain amount of T cells from the patient. You need to genetically modify them, and then you need to expand them. Some patients don't have a lot of T cells. Older patients have more difficulty having them be successfully genetically modified and expanded. And that's an issue for patients where the average age of diagnosis is 70. The T cells that are genetically modified, we don't know exactly what dose to give, and we don't even know if it matters, because if they're going to expand, well, you're essentially giving a drug that increases in dose whenever it sees a target. So we don't even know if the initial cell dose is important, but certainly the T cells are infused, pretty rapidly through an IV line, and then a proportion of them go from their bloodstream into their bone marrow. And usually that's a target-rich environment.
The next one is pretty important as well. What is the timeline that you are looking for this therapy to be practically being administered to patients as a treatment?
So I imagine, you know, for our clinical trial, we're looking to have this start up in the summer of 2016. But I think this question is really, when do you think this stuff is going to get FDA approved to do in any old cancer center? And I think it's a number of years away to be able to find an intervention that's both safe, reliable, and I think we're a number of years away from FDA approval in myeloma.
Number being 2, 5, 10?
I wish I had some sort of granularity on that, and I don't. You know, this is a rapidly changing field where 5 years ago, we weren't talking about this in myeloma, and certainly weren't talking about it occurring for autologous CAR T cells, potentially allogeneic, and, all this is new and in a rapidly changing field.
Okay, and obviously at Ohio State, but are there other centers that will also be able to have access to this treatment?
Certainly there are other centers doing it now, right? University of Pennsylvania, Dana-Farber, the NCI, National Cancer Institute, are doing these trials that have eligibility in myeloma. I know of other trials that are going to be opening up kind of across the world in London, France, and other spots in the U.S. So
are your CS1 trials?
The CS1 trial for myeloma is likely to start out at Ohio State and probably won't be at other centers.
And then after what length of this therapy do you expect to see improvements in a patient's condition?
Well, the expansion of these CAR T cells usually occurs in most diseases in the first 2 weeks. So we'd certainly want to see a response right around 2 to 4 weeks after the initial infusion. And if we don't see a response in 4 weeks, you'd think that their likelihood of response is very low.
One of the papers on this technology mentions that treatment of patients with CAR T cells can cause cytokine storms, which in the setting of allogeneic transplant may induce graft versus host disease. Could you please explain what cytokine storm is and what in the CAR T cell triggers this reaction?
So every time that you infuse these CAR T cells into a patient in the proper environment, in a target-rich environment, these T cells expand. They see a target, and where there was one T cell seeing a target, then there's two. And where two cells see a target, then there's four. And you can imagine with that type of mathematics, it's not long for your 500,000 genetically modified CAR T cells to quickly turn into 5 million and 5 billion T cells. Well, as this happens, T cells that are in such a target-rich environment, these are cells that, by their nature, when they're surrounded by what they think of as foreign, become aggravated. And their job in general is to kill all the foreign cells, and they are now genetically modified to see the patient's myeloma cells as foreign or the patient's cancer cells as foreign thus far. And when this happened in the past, a lot of aggravated CAR T cells being rapidly produced, some of the things that they use, these T cells, to kill the cells around them are called cytokines. And so they tend to leak these cytokines into the marrow and into the blood. But with such a rapid expansion, these cytokines or chemicals leak into the blood and can cause the patient to be incredibly sick. And this can occur with an allergic reaction. This can occur in a number of spots where you have all these particular type of chemicals shoot up in the blood. And these patients can become incredibly sick, develop what looks to be a pneumonia, dialysis may be required due to kidney failure, they can lose all their blood pressure and require ICU admissions. These patients are sick. And when these line of testing and these CAR T cells trials were at the beginning, this was pretty mysterious. But it wasn't long before people figured out what was going on, and in parallel, there's a group of drugs that are anti-cytokine therapies. They target these chemicals specifically. Interleukin-6 is a target for a lot of these drugs, and when they lower interleukin-6 levels, after giving these drugs, patients get quickly better. So what we hope to do is monitor patients for these cytokine storms, and if they occur, to have this supportive therapy administered early before patients become sick. This will allow the CAR T cells to still expand and do their job, but not have such rapid expansion that it puts the patient vulnerable. and causes them to be sick.
Very interesting. Thank you so much. Does the risk of becoming a non-secretor increase as patients survive longer? And how should this affect monitoring, you know, the labs, PET scans, et cetera?
So being a non-secretor, some patients at diagnosis are non-secretors, and some patients do become non-secretors, but, you know, in my experience, it's the minority of patients. And following non-secretory myeloma is difficult because no one particularly wants to do a bone marrow biopsy every clinic visit. And a bone marrow biopsy in myeloma only tells you what's going on that side of your pelvic bone, which is not necessarily indicative of what's going on in the entire patient. Sometimes patients with myeloma bone disease who are non-secretors, you can follow via CAT scan, MRIs, and PET scans. But a lot of times PET scans are not particularly helpful here either because it only detects the most aggressive myeloma. And somewhere between 20 and 40% of patients with myeloma bone disease have PET negative disease. So following non-secretory myeloma is a challenge, especially since many clinicians often follow myeloma patients simply by blood tests. I think the biggest...
When you said the PET scans, that's news to me, that 20% of bone disease is not identified through a PET scan. So how is it identified?
So you can see it on CAT scan. You can see it on X-ray. X-ray obviously is probably the most insensitive way because it requires cortical destruction. The outer part of the bone has to be destroyed before it shows up on X-ray. Cross-sectional imaging like CTs and MRIs are much more sensitive. And PET scan can be even more sensitive than CTs and MRIs, but it can occasionally be less sensitive because it requires that the myeloma cells that are non-secretory are metabolically active enough to pick up the dye used in the PET scan. So non-secretory disease generally requires that patients be followed reliably by either the same physician or excellent documentation to state, hey, listen, this patient doesn't secrete, so don't bother doing the myeloma labs all that often or depending on them. Make sure you depend on cross-sectional imaging like CTs and MRIs and occasionally PET scans to follow their disease, as that's most likely to be accurate.
Now, all the people who are not non-secretors, then the PET scan works for them? It's just these non-secretors where it's an issue?
No, it can be. PET scans may be insensitive in both secretory and non-secretory disease. PET scans are insensitive in patients whose myeloma doesn't pick up the dye quickly, and that may not have anything to do with whether they're secretory or non-secretory disease.
Well, that's news to me, but that's interesting. Thanks. I appreciate that. Got one last question, and that is that a person says that they want to pose a question to you that they feel is off subject, and they think it's off subject because there's a fine line between immunity and autoimmunity. Dr. Hoffmeister mentioned on previous Cure Talk call that he had observed that myeloma patients with autoimmune disease experience an increase to their autoimmunity while their myeloma is improving with treatment. Could he expand upon that observation as well as any other learnings about myeloma and autoimmune disease?
Sure. So autoimmune diseases are well known. Rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis, lupus, connective tissue diseases, all these are when your body is attacking itself, really. And that doesn't necessarily mean that these patients who have an autoimmune disease are protected against developing myeloma. In fact, they can. But myeloma in and of itself is very immunosuppressive. So if your myeloma flares, usually the patient's autoimmune disease simmers down. So we are often fond to say that having active rheumatoid arthritis and active myeloma cannot happen at the same time in the same patient. And what we have seen is patients who have an autoimmune disease, or maybe they don't, and they develop myeloma. And then after treatment, their myeloma goes into a deep remission. And then their autoimmune disease flares. And then as their myeloma becomes more active, their autoimmune disease simmers down. And sometimes you get this back and forth. This doesn't occur that often, right?
But in a hard place.
Right. And, you know, it requires somebody have an autoimmune disease and myeloma, but they do occur in the same patient population, but usually not in the same population at the same time.
Okay. That's quite interesting. Well, those were all of the questions that we had for you, Doctor. And as always, you have been a wealth of knowledge, and we really appreciate all the things that you're doing, especially with this CAR T-cell study, because it looks so good, and your results to date have been very good. Priya, do you have anybody else online that would like to ask a question, or would you like to...
Thank you so much, Gary. I think we're almost come to the end of the hour. Dr. Hoffmeister, it was great listening to you. Thank you so very much for having taken time out to share this information about the new therapy with our audience. Gary, Pat, and Jack, as usual, thank you so much for your participation. And today's talk and its transcript will be made available on Cure Talk's website. Please visit www.curetalks.com for details on our upcoming talks. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Priya. Thank you, Doctor.
Priya.
Yes, thank you. Nice to talk with everybody.
Thank you. Bye-bye.